We're going to talk about music today, but we're going to talk about it in a way that it doesn't normally get talked about. Like, we'll talk about what colors music is and what happens when you don't remember playing it. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. Stop walking. That's the band Throwing Muses with Not Too Soon off their album The Real Ramona, 1991. Kristen Hirsch on vocals and guitar. Kristen Hirsch is now 56 years old, and for almost all of those years, she's been singing and playing guitar. Throwing Muses, formed when she was 14, has released 10 studio albums over the years and a couple of live ones. Kristen has also done a lot of work with her other band, 50 Foot Wave, and she's made 11 solo albums. Her music is sometimes described as trippy, like she's transported to some other place. And the thing is, that's kind of reductive, but also kind of true. Because for many years, Kristen Hirsch dissociated while performing on stage, like literally could not remember playing the songs that she had just played. She has also experienced a lot of synesthesia, seeing chords and sounds as colors. Kristen has written several books, most recently Seeing Sideways, a memoir of music and motherhood. She's been working out a lot of things over the years, a bipolar diagnosis that she now no longer believes to be accurate, trauma involving her firstborn child, which she'll explain, and Kristen Hirsch has just been trying to figure out how she works. Kristen Hirsch, welcome to Depression Mode.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's so much to talk about in terms of your music and kind of your journey, but I want to start with a thing that isn't really a mental disorder at all, but is a mentally fascinating thing, which is synesthesia. Can you explain what that is and what that's been in your life?
It's difficult to compare it to anything because I haven't known much else, but I've always heard chords as colors. The way notes combine adds nuance to the color. So D major, for example, is a primary yellow. And D minor, when you go from F sharp to F, it becomes an ochre. If you play the seventh, there's an orange tinge when you turn the D into a C. So there are colors associated with notes, but only relative to each other. I didn't realize this until I asked my father to show me some chords, and he bored me. And what? The way I said that, I was a little kid, and the way I described my boredom was, you only showed me red, blue, and yellow. I want to know, magenta and turquoise. It sounds really lame, but I was a kid. Kids can't be lame, right?
No, it's interesting. So you were you like hearing music on the radio and seeing the colors that you heard?
Not necessarily. I don't mean to insult anybody, but it only works with real music. Like on the radio, because there was an impurity to the chord in the production, like it's sort of the egoic presentation. It would blur my impression of the notes themselves. If they play something good on the radio, then yeah, the colors come out of it. But so I was unaware that I had this rainbow issue. But I started my band just a few years later. We were very young, like 12. And I don't know how anyone else remembers all those chords. It's hard enough to remember all the words.
Yeah. So this goes back as far as you can remember in terms of like playing guitar then.
Yes. And my dad was a hippie, so he kind of knew enough chords to play Bob Dylan and Neil Young songs, which is four. And then Appalachian folk songs. My parents are from Lookout Mountain in Chattanooga. And so the chords were very fundamental, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that's just fine for a hippie dad, but I wanted to play ochre and burgundy.
Turquoise. And
yeah.
I want to ask about your dad, and I want to ask about your childhood here in a second, but I just, synesthesia is one of these things that I've often heard about, but I don't know that I've ever met anybody who's actually had it, so I'm just monopolizing your time to explain it a little bit. So are you, do you imagine those colors in order to get to those chords, or like, are you seeing it as you play it? Like, are you visualizing it, or do you actually see it in the world? How does that all work?
They are the same to me. Color, you can picture a color. So when I hear a chord, I picture the color, though I don't hear the chord when I see the color. I know some musicians who have synesthesia, and I know someone who can smell notes.
Wow.
And I know there's an Oliver Sacks book that includes a chapter on this, because someone handed it to me in San Francisco, and it, I thought, yes, now we can prove that this is a truism. And this is, there's some vibrational reality to this, because when you meditate, you can get to the point of synesthesia. So I figure, oh, we win then. You know, we're right. You're right. Wrong. You're just not zen enough to get it.
Yeah.
And I read that chapter, and they were all wrong about the colors of the chords. I almost threw the book across the room. It made me so sick to have them get the colors wrong, because I had always assumed that there is some deep truth to the vibrational facility of notes reverberating, and some prism of the sky is not true.
Spectrum of colors, yeah.
It's my personal rainbow, goddammit.
That's just how you turned out. So is that where you grew up, in Tennessee?
I was born in Georgia. I lived on a commune when I was little. And so it wasn't just Appalachian folk songs, but a lot of, acid rock. I went to Woodstock when I was a toddler, stuff like that.
Wow, do you remember that?
Nah.
No.
It wasn't my first concert. How sad is that?
Wow. So was there a lot of music all around you growing up? Were people playing live music all around you growing up?
Yeah, quietly. It wasn't too wild. I mean, they were on drugs, you know, so they were tired. It was calm, and we lived in the woods in a big barn.
Not a lot of Marshall stacks out there in the woods, I imagine.
No, it was, hippies are gentle people, especially when you tire them out with drugs. I just wanted so desperately to see what they were seeing. I remember that sadness, frustration. I thought I needed glasses. I couldn't. They would describe what they were seeing to me, and I was a kid, so, it went in.
you thought you were doing it wrong because you weren't seeing what they were seeing?
Yeah. I remember a lady saying, and we were out on a raft on a lake, and she was saying, "Kristen, look at all the ostriches with their heads in the sand. And how wonderful would that be to live in the woods, and there are ostriches there." But, there weren't.
Not so much. So then were you out of the commune by the time you started your first bands when you were 12?
Yes.
Okay. Where was that?
My dad's a philosophy professor, so he got a university job, and we went up north to New England, where I am right now. This is where I've been recording for most of my life.
Okay. What led to starting that band?
I don't know. I mean, why would a 12-year-old do anything? Boredom, well, right?
most of them don't start bands, though. It's like Tommy Stinson and you, pretty much, is all I can think of.
I don't know. It was a calling. I wasn't as intense as I became in Throwing Muses when we started. We thought we were a party band. We played parties, so we were a party band. And I don't think any of the kids on this island where we live knew the difference. And I certainly, it wouldn't have occurred to me that I was from outer space. I'm me. So I had to wait till we started playing out when we were like 14 to hear that they thought I was crazy. And that was sad.
What do you mean crazy?
It's still sad. I don't know. I didn't say it. They did. I think it was that we had developed our own sonic vocabulary, and I was writing from an unusual place, which was dissociation. I didn't know it, but I didn't have any memory of writing the songs or playing them, except for a sort of fuzzy, vague impression like a dream. And my bandmates were used to this. And we all sort of thought, wow, art is wild. And all the journalists thought the same thing. So when I would say, I disappear when I play, they heard that metaphorically and they supported me in it. But it got very difficult. The songs started to take over. They were my gods. And I felt very strongly that they were pushing my life around so that I would give them sound bodies and that I wasn't going to last much longer. And I was only a teenager then, so it didn't take too many years for us to get Throwing Muses intense.
Yeah. Did the dissociation start when you started playing music, or was it around before that?
I believe it has always been, or at least since I was very young. And because I heard music that way, I experienced music that way. They found me in first grade. They lost track of me and found me behind a bookshelf crying because of a song. My father's name is Dude. Dude had played for me because I had like a school morning stomach ache. I was nervous. And he said, I'll play you this song. And he played Go Tell Aunt Rhody. I don't know if you know that song. It's,
sure. The old Grey Goose is
dead. He's dead. She's dead, right? And yeah. The goslings are crying. And you can't do that to a kid. So
it's a terrible
I
song.
Couldn't.
It's a very upsetting song. Yeah.
No shit. I couldn't handle it. So I disappeared. And they found me in my other personality behind the bookshelf. And I know what it was going on now, but I didn't then. And when I wrote my first book, Rat Girl, it was based on a diary I kept as a teenager, and I didn't know then. So I couldn't write in Rat Girl what was going on. I only found out very recently what has been happening all these years. And it was a different kind of sadness, but also a little triumphant because I had always maintained art and mental illness don't necessarily go together in a sick way. It's just the question marks we put around those orientations that add a sickness and our happiness. Are you happy? You know, are you too dark to live? Do you feel sick? But I had just maintained that this is music and I was right. But the problem was I wasn't happy. I was gonna die. So by the time I was playing out and being called crazy, I had started to realize, well, other people remember being on stage. Other people remember writing and rehearsing and playing. But it was such a god to me. It was such a thing to worship that.
Music was?
I didn't let go. Yeah, yeah. Everyone who has ever cared about me has told me to stop.
To stop what?
Stop playing.
To stop playing, because it's
as if I could stop the music that way, yeah.
So the personality of you that was making the music, did she only exist when the music was happening?
I thought so. Now I realize she was the one living through all pain, all trauma. And I haven't had an easy life. My relationship to memory is odd. It's photographic with huge black holes. So, you know, in retrospect, it makes sense. But when you're lost in a perception of selfhood, the idea of looking for time that you have lost is unfathomable. Where do you go to find it? It's gone.
A lot of time, and we've talked about dissociation a little bit on our show, but, you know, it's not as common as a lot of other things. So it's sometimes hard to find a lot of stories about it. But from what I understand, it's often tied to an upsetting event, a traumatic event that becomes so traumatic that your brain says, I'm going to separate this out. I can't process this. I'm going to put this over here. And then it kind of starts to grow like a cutting from a plant almost sort of thing. Do you trace it to an upsetting event in particular?
I can trace it. Actually, no, not really. I don't know that I want to. It's been hard enough.
Yeah, just managing it.
Yeah, the intensity of the music mirrors any darkness I have lived. And it was useful for a while. I was a very good friend and bandmate and wife and mother and everything. I was a very nice lady, and I still am. But there was something missing, and it was all in the music. And it was difficult for people to put them together. I was used to it, but even reviews would be so baffled between my backstage and onstage, what they called personas, but they weren't personas. They were both me.
Right, right. Well, and I think, too, it's kind of mythologized with art in general and music in particular of like, oh, no, she's going into a zone. This is where she's really brilliant. You know, you've got to give her the space to just do that. But it's
yes.
But you were in so much pain.
Yes, and my stage fright was incapacitating, obviously, because I had no idea what happened out there, and I was being handled from a very young age, and other people were making money because of it, and so they just sort of. They handle you and they give you pills. And it's just, it's very much like old Hollywood that way. And I was the mad genius. And, but I wasn't. I kept saying, this is your sister and you and your daughter and your neighbor. This is just
being.
Real.
Yeah.
Yes. And what they were comparing me to was the music business. So it's actually like a cultural issue in some ways. They would call us crazy if we were from another culture. And in America, the entertainment industry is a pseudo-culture, and it's our biggest export. And it's an economy. And it's a lot like a pimp and a whore, and we're all familiar with that, but it really hit home in my life. And I was never going to be a part of that problem, that sexist. It's just such an offense. Yes.
Yeah.
And I wasn't going to turn my back on women, and I wasn't going to turn my back on music. So they put me in the category of mad genius, and nobody helped me. You know, I was alone there.
Right, they got to keep you mad for you to be an operational mad genius. I have so many questions about your career in terms of operating within the industry, given the person you are and given the mind that you have. Tell me what happened with the car accident you were in as a teenager.
This was more than just a fender bender, and it matters a lot to Kristen's story. More after a quick break.
I'm sure you've noticed how giant corporations are controlling more and more about what we consume, whether it's our food, our news, or even the shows we enjoy.
The Greatest Generation is a show that stands up to big Star Trek and says no. We can laugh about costumes that fit too tightly in the groin area.
We can make a Star Trek podcast that's basically only about that.
The Greatest Generation. The show for free and independent thinkers about Star Trek.
And the groins of different costumes.
Reviewing every episode in order.
So subscribe to The Greatest Generation on MaximumFun.org. You'll be doing your part in telling the Star Trek industrial complex that they can't control your mind.
You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace.
I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh. Back with Kristen Hirsch of the bands Throwing Muses and 50 Foot Wave. Kristen's teenage years were busy. Starts her band, goes to college earlier than one might expect. More about that in a bit. And then there was the car accident.
That's when I started hearing the songs that I had been creating as the alternate. I was in the hospital. The accident was gross because it's a car accident.
Sure.
But it didn't upset me. It still doesn't. And that, some people think that's where PTSD came from, or I was dissociating then. Or, I don't care about physical stuff. And yeah, my leg came off and stuff, but I put it back on and
Your leg came off? What do you mean?
It did, yeah. Well, it was underneath the rest of my leg and I put it back. I found it and put it back on.
Oh my God.
My face was gone. It slid off on the cement when I flew up into the air and landed. I had a double, possibly triple concussion. And I think that's what, I don't really know, but either that or the alternate just couldn't bear any more pain. And so she started showing herself then. But in the hospital, I heard noises and I asked nurses what they were and realized they didn't hear them. So I got embarrassed. And gradually, these industrial sounds became my own sonic vocabulary and they were forming themselves into bass, drums, guitar parts. And I would teach them to my drummer and my bass player. And that's what we were. That's what Throwing Muses was. And it was okay because it was still beautiful. It was still, you know, it really was not from outer space. It was just from another part of me that was pretty upset.
So it was like Bob Dylan describes the period around his motorcycle accident, whatever that was, as like he was writing down music that was coming from somewhere else. That he had heard it, and it was almost like he was just taking dictation for a long time.
That's what my experience has been, as if someone was playing a Throwing Muses record that hadn't been recorded yet, and I was just copying it down. But they thought I said that. I said everything. And I have had mental health practitioners say, I was there in the audience for years, thinking you were just zoning out while you were exhibiting classic symptoms of switching, and I'm sorry.
Yeah. Huh. So then coming out of that, you were, what, 16, 17 years old?
Yeah.
Yeah. And was that when Throwing Muses as a band started to kind of take off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So then it was probably a lot of encouragement of, you know, whatever is happening with you, you need to keep doing it because...
Oh, yeah.
We can make money off you.
Right, exactly. But I didn't hear those conversations. I wasn't much of a talker. And I didn't like the photo shoots. I wasn't doing anything except the music. And that's very unusual. Anyone you've ever heard of, because they're the ones that they do the tap dance, whether they were ever a musician or not. The ones we've heard of are the ones willing to play the game. And I didn't even see the game. I had bandmates that I loved who were musicians, and they sort of made sure that I was as happy as I could be. And I was. I'm a very happy person, so that I could go up there and do that thing.
And go somewhere else once you were up there.
Yes, and I didn't really know what that was. I was the only one who had never witnessed it.
So when you were on stage, were you thinking, you know, were you as Chris, and I'm sorry, I'm fumbling because this is really, you know, this is a lot, but were you thinking, okay, what song is next on our set list? Or, you know, what chords does this, what colors does this song require? You know, or, hey, are they, you know, is the bass turned up too loud or something? Or do you not even remember doing the shows?
I can remember in between songs.
Okay.
And that's when I would say, I would mark the colors and the chords and try and remember the lyrics. And I have a craft. It takes years to develop a craft. I took classical guitar for years and I didn't dissociate then. I didn't need to. There was no trauma associated with it. And so it became more like a hobby, but I ended up with facile hands and an understanding of theory. And if I play a bad song, I don't dissociate. There's no magic.
You can get through Happy Birthday and be just fine.
I'm totally fine then, yeah. Okay. Or if I do a cover, I wouldn't dissociate then, obviously, you know.
And something that I didn't realize, because I figured, well, okay, she's, you know, got this talent. She's being recognized. The band starts to take off. She never sees the front door of a college, but you went to college, right?
I started college early.
Okay. Yeah. How early?
I was probably 14, 15.
Because you were just so smart?
Yeah. I don't know how to answer that. Because I was a dork, more like. But my best friend in college was the movie star Betty Hutton. Do you know who that is?
Sure, yeah. How was Betty Hutton your best friend?
She left Hollywood at the peak of her career. She lost $10 million and ended up here in New England living with some Catholic priests who took her in and let her be their kind of maid, I guess, and, you know, saved her soul, that kind of thing. And they convinced her to go to college. And she was in her 60s, I think. So she was too old to have any friends, and I was too young to have any friends. So we hung out, and she wanted to talk showbiz. And me, of all people, like, it's so sad that she couldn't find some actual girl with some stupid band who wanted to talk showbiz. I had to have this freaking smart, crazy band. But she and her priest would come to all of Throwing Music shows when we were teenagers. And
wow.
I know.
And if people are hearing this and they're not familiar with Betty Hutton, trivia fact, the song It's Oh So Quiet that you associate with Bjork was a Betty Hutton song long before.
Betty was bonkers.
Betty
but
was
good
something.
Bonkers. She had a very big heart. And actually, I dedicated my first book to her, and she's in it a lot because it's just a year from my diary from this time we're talking about. And I had to say, it's the only time I step in from the future to alter the past that is the diary by saying everything Betty said was true. I thought she was out of her mind. You couldn't Google stalk somebody. I didn't know she was a movie star. I didn't care. It's just like a job you used to have. But the stories she told were full of, you know, cigar chomping moguls and all that.
Right. Starlets.
It's not like that anymore. Yeah. And but she was right. It all came true. And she was even right about throwing muses having too many syllables.
So you have, you know, the music going on, you have college going on, you have Betty Hutton going on. Was there a crossroads where you thought of doing a more academic career, a more, you know, something using a college degree versus signing to a label and being in a band?
Yeah, I had to choose between a scholarship to McGill to study medicine and a recording contract with 4AD when I was, I guess, 18. I was pregnant, and I thought, I'll raise the baby in Canada, you know, so I have a little Canadian kid. And
go to med school.
Nobody's going to call me crazy then. Yeah, it's all of this is going to go away. But it was because of Betty, really. She said, you know, just hit this first mark, is what she said. And I tried, and I signed the contract instead. And in the studio, I realized this is not something that can be captured. Music is not something that you can put in a bottle. You're struck by lightning when you try to put lightning in a bottle.
Why did you go music instead of med school?
Because Betty said, just do this. Just stand where you are. You've done this. And I just read her autobiography. Somebody sent it to me just a few weeks ago. And now I realize why she did it. It's because she wanted to run away whenever it got dark. And she was telling me, no, don't run away. And in fact, I took the bus to her when I ran away from the studio and said, this is not right. There's something wrong with this. They're calling music a dead thing, and they're making it a dead thing. And she didn't know what I was talking about. But she said, this is your only commitment. Just fulfill this one commitment. And yeah, of course, there's no such thing. You're just in it then.
The commitment being a record contract?
Yes.
Yeah. So you sign the record contract, and then Throwing Muses is out in the world, and I'm listening to it on college radio and and the whole thing. And how was your mental health going into that, and how did your mental health inform what happened next?
Well, to be fair, dissociation is a survival mechanism. They called me schizophrenic. They called me bipolar. And when I wrote my book, Rat Girl, or Paradoxical Undressing Outside the U.S., Penguin decided that Paradoxical Undressing, the original title, was too many syllables for Americans.
Again with the syllables. So,
it's like a problem of mine.
Throw Muse with Kristen Hirsch, with Chris Hirsch.
I
was asking about, we're talking about the dissociation.
Yeah. Well, Rat Girl is a book about being misdiagnosed bipolar. And then, you know, when it was published, I became the poster child for bipolar disorder.
Right.
It's been a long uphill battle that is not helped by the number of people who call themselves musicians pretending to be mentally ill. And I'm saying, I'm not mentally ill. This is a coping mechanism. It's a survival mechanism. But I did not have the vocabulary until very recently. My EMDR practitioner gave me, you know, the vocabulary with which to fight back.
I really want to get to the EMDR because it was a huge difference in your life, and I've gone through it as well. So I'm really interested to hear about it from what you went through. But I feel like I'm taking you on a tour of all the most upsetting moments of your childhood.
No, but, shit. Yeah, I was not know. Looking forward to this interview.
This
You're a very nice man. Everything I try not to think about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, let's briefly at least touch on, you had a baby and then he was taken away from you. This was, I believe, in your late teens, early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And was that a taken away by the state kind of situation?
No. His father was jealous because I was with someone else. And he lied to me, told me that my mother, there was an emergency. I had to go to my mother. I didn't have time to call her just before cell phones. And I said, I just put the baby down for a nap. He said, I'll watch him. I got to my mother's house. She didn't know what I was talking about. And a cop served me papers and said, it's a restraining order. This is child abandonment. I said, I left 5 minutes ago. I was lied to. I was tricked. And where's the baby? He says, your assets are frozen. You can't go anywhere near your baby without going to jail. And that's where my PTSD came from. I did not care about a car accident or anything else in my life, but this is the ongoing tragedy that my son and I have had to live with that I never got him back. We love each other, but the fact that something like that can happen in America, and that there was no way to come back from being someone in a rock band. Lawyer said, if you weren't a musician, you might have a chance. And I said, I'll quit. He said, it's too late.
You're an artist. It's already on your record.
Exactly. It was very easy to take him away.
And then what form did that take in terms of the PTSD that would come later? You know, because as you say, it's never really over after that. It's
exactly.
It's happened, but it's not over.
And people would say, it happened a long time ago, and I knew what they meant, but I also knew that they were wrong. Nothing like that can happen a long time ago. It's always happening, and they seemed to understand. They could grasp that, but they didn't know that, you know, you duck with flying colors when you think it's happening again. Anything that would remind me of summer, if there was a child crying, which happens a lot more than you know, they're in the grocery store crying, you know, I would start to pass out, to throw up, to cry. And the EMDR, as you know, is miraculous. It moves the event back in time. So, whereas I stand by the gripping effect of something tragic, I know I'm with the people who have lived through tragedies. How many mothers have lost their children forever? How many mothers have had them taken away? I'm just one of them. It's no longer hell opening up and swallowing me.
We're going to get into EMDR and what that did for Kristen Hirsch. We'll explain what EMDR is as well. And if you've never heard of it, it might sound pretty strange, but for a whole lot of people, it works very well. Let's go to break on a little Betty Hutton music. This is from 1951, decades before she was Kristen's college pal.
It's oh so still, shh, shh, you're all alone. And so peaceful until you fall in love. Zing, boom, the sky up above. Zing, boom, it's caving in. Wham, bam, you've never been so nuts about a guy you want to love.
Hi, it's Kevin from Max Fun HQ. This year for Giving Tuesday, we're inviting you to a super fun tarot event. It's got some of your favorite Max Fun hosts, and it's for a great cause. joined Depeche Mode's John Moe, Carrie Poppy of Oh No Ross and Carrie, Stuart Wellington from The Flophouse, Tom Lum from Let's Learn Everything, and Ellen Weatherford of Just the Zoo of Us. Your suggested $10 donation supports National CASA GAL and their work advocating for kids in foster care. That's this Giving Tuesday, November 29th at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out MaximumFun.org/events for more information and tickets to The Tarot Show with John Moe.
Back with Kristen Hirsch, musician and author. Before the break, we were talking about EMDR, which is a particular type of therapy aimed at addressing post-traumatic stress.
So, EMDR, let's talk a little bit about what that was for you. EMDR, just so people know, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. It's a form of therapy. How long after the event, the kidnapping of your son, did you get to EMDR? How many years were in between?
25.
That's a lot of years.
Yeah. It was difficult to function. My bandmates would walk down the aisle on a flight to, you know, tour in Australia and say, Chris can't watch this movie. Everyone knew my triggers. You know, Chris can't go into this room. And I was not careful about myself. I'm not like that. I had to be the strong one. I was a band leader. I had to be the one who did all the work and lived without sleep. And you're always the one that really on the front lines. And I wasn't taken care of. And yet, for this machine to function, we all had to watch for triggers. So it's, as you know, it's made a huge difference in my life to not be subject to that.
Well, and you're a mom of four boys. My sister has four boys as well. And I'm stunned even at the thought of having only been one boy myself. I just think, four boys, my God. But that must have been a world of car seats and babies crying and just a bag of triggers all the time.
No, they were filling my arms. Oh. My own children were not triggers. Dooney, I saw he wasn't gone from my life. And he's beautiful, but we have the same sad eyes because of this. And you know, as he puts it, someday he'll be in his 70s and I'll be in my 80s. And there won't be any difference between us. And maybe then the mother-son pain will go away.
Is he the one who said the thing about the scars that's in your latest book?
Oh, that's the youngest, Bodhi.
That's the youngest.
Isn't that beautiful? Bodhi said that we were riding our bikes in New Orleans on Magazine Street, and we were talking about, you know, life pain and living through it together. And I said, it all leaves scars. Like, be ready. It's whether the psychological, physical, doesn't matter. You are changed. They leave a scar. And he said, but Mom, all scars are beautiful because you lived. I was like, I took his picture and I was like, I never want to forget you saying this. He's like,
God damn, that's beautiful.
He meant it and he's right.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes somebody who has fewer miles on them can say that with such a lack of guile. Like
it's true. And no censorship whatsoever.
No censorship and no concept of just how heavy and beautiful he's being with that.
It's true, yeah. They're little animals. I was lucky to have four Buddhist bells keeping me awake like that. Guileless is a good word. There's nothing between them and the truth. The number of times I've feared for their lives and their health and their little psyches was worth their guileless nature.
So EMDR is this form of psychotherapy that is about processing a traumatic event and not being so stuck on it. And it involves eye movement, as the title would indicate. Sometimes there are lights that you're guided to follow, or there are buzzers in your hand that you're guided to follow. What form did it take for you?
Both. I watched the bar of lights and held the electrodes, and they were buzzing along with the lights. It was brutal, you know.
Yeah.
I would collapse on the way in.
Yeah. Then the therapist is working with you over the traumatic memory, like the specific sense memory details of the traumatic event that happened to you?
Yes. And because it wasn't me, it wasn't about me and my safety, it was about a child, it took a long time. I do a lot of readings where like Gulf War vets come and we talk about PTSD together. And the ones that can relate the most and have had the hardest times are the ones whose traumatic memories involve children. When we fear for our own lives, you get to a point where you're only talking about life itself. Your ego is gone. You're not saying this person with a name must live. Obviously, that's not true. You're going to die. But the effect of being the caretaker of an organism is just exponentially impactful when it's a child.
I wonder if you had a similar experience that I did when you heard, maybe you're more open-minded than I am. When I heard about EMDR, I thought, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of. Like, are you crazy? Like, I'm going to think about something and then I'm going to follow some light back and forth and then I'm going to be better. But I was in such a desperate situation. I'm like, I don't care. I will try anything. And it was
right.
And it was a miracle.
Yes. Well, I'm actually more mistrustful than you. When I hear people say that they think they know why something works, or they think they have figured it out, particularly in biology, where there's no such thing as a no-brainer.
Right. It's all mental health.
I was intrigued by the notion that they didn't know how it worked. I was like, ah, you left a little lacuna there, and so I trust you that much more. You're not pretending to know everything for once.
Right. And so how long did it take, and what were the effects of it that you noticed right away?
It took a few months, actually. And a lot of these other sufferers of PTSD that have come to my readings say that it worked faster for them. But the problem was that at the same time, the practitioner realized that I was dissociative. I had never heard that before. I had heard of the phenomenon, but how do you find lost time? Like I said, I was just simply not aware of it. And my experience with my band was, I thought, what music is. And for me, that's what music was like. So
you get lost in it and you're in the zone.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Exactly. So this was my actual life and I was losing track of it. I was disappearing for hours because everything was falling apart. With the EMDR, the PTSD was being addressed, but the dissociation was becoming out of control. And I had there were no reins to pull back. It wasn't in music anymore.
It was just other parts of your life? It was all over the place?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, all over the place. And its effectiveness had come to an end. So while, you know, the snowballing of your own neurology that follows EMDR can be difficult. It's not instantly miraculous, but it can be very difficult as your neurology changes and your psychology is trying to chase it around. I had to be on a Throwing Muses promo tour, and the practitioner, I was on the phone from London with her. I said, you make this stop. I can't, no one could live through this. I'm experiencing every trauma of my life and every song at the same time. And she said, I'm not doing this. You are. She's like, well, you still have to make it stop. And she said, well, let's just decide that if you live through it, then you lived through it. I was like, well, that's what everyone decides about everything. Like, can't we do better than that? It's like, I got to be on the BBC tomorrow. And so I went to this interview, and the woman, it's just BBC radio, luckily, but nobody could see me at the time. But she knew what was going on. She'd been briefed to not trigger me in any way and all this. And instead, she said, I know what's going on with you right now. I want you to pick up that guitar and play Sun Ray Venus for me from the new Throwing Muses record. And I looked at her like, the fuck are you doing?
Wow.
But it's live on the air. You can't really say that. She was just vibing me. So, hey, I'm a nice person. I picked up the guitar and I played it. And I was enchanted. I could follow. I wasn't disappearing. I could see the chords. I knew what the song was about. I was fully present. I was enjoying it. It wasn't the devil. It was just a song. And the song is probably more important than anything else. But it was just a full-on body walking into the room, and I was...
You were there the whole time.
Not in control, but yeah, I wasn't out of control either for the first time ever. And so when I finished it, I looked up at her. I'm like happy.
Yeah.
Like grinning, and she's got tears pouring down her face, and she's making that like dead air sign with her hands, meaning you have to fill...
Right.
Right. Dead air.
Stretch
like,
it.
No.
Add another chorus.
Yeah. I'm kind of glad she did that, because then I realized, oh, my career isn't over. Like, I can tour with the band, and now, you know, we're in the dressing room, and instead of doing deals with God, I'm going like, you know, tick, tick, come on, time to go, boys.
Wow.
They're like, who are you, and where is Kristen?
Oh, that's beautiful. I mean, it. You and I had been emailing a little bit before the interview. You said that with the EMDR, you were able to put what happened with your baby into the past where it belonged. And that was the big breakthrough that I had as well. Like, oh, this has happened. This isn't continually happening. And I think that's the trauma brain that says, you know, it's like in The Body Keeps the Score, the Bessel van der Kolk book, that your body is always running it through again, always wants to run through it. Your mind is saying, let's put this through again, see if we can make sense of it this time. And of course, you can't. But the EMDR puts it back there.
And you think it's coming.
Yeah.
If anything reminds you of it.
Here it comes again.
It's worse than life. It's more than life and death. It's like, It's hell opening up.
And it can be so beautiful when you get to play that song at the BBC. I mean, for me, when I play songs at the BBC, it goes quite well. I don't play any songs at the BBC.
Well, you know, to be fair, I was in London, you know, on that tour. I was staying with a friend who is an actor, and he and I would meet up in the kitchen. I would come home from work at like 2 or 3 in the morning when he was getting up to go to the TV studio for makeup. So we would just sort of, there's that time where it's not night and it's not day. And so you better talk about something important or just goof the fuck around. And that's what we would do generally. And I could tell he had come to his first Throwing Muses show. And so we met up in the kitchen from the same event, and I was just, you know, I was at work. I'm used to what I do. I've been doing it for like 40 years. And I could tell there was something going on, something he wanted to say. I was like, what? And he said, I hate to tell you this, but you were disappearing up there. And I said, I know. It's because I'm so tired. It's the end of the tour, and she's just so much better at it than I am.
She's been doing it a long time.
Yes, she's really good. And I have to try when I do it. So I do still disappear.
Yeah.
But I think I do it on purpose because I'm better when I'm her.
Well, it sounds like you're the manager now. Like you're the one in charge.
Yeah.
Which has got to be really nice to get that promotion.
To disappear when you're talking about music, it's not a bad idea, because in order to be a song, you need to be empty. In order to write a song, you can't have plans for it. And to be the kind of performer that is not about pageantry, vanity, and ego, you have to get to a selfless place. And I learned that with a wild tool, but an effective one. And I stand by it.
Yeah. So when you're making music now with, you know, whatever project it is and whatever style of music it is, does it feel, I mean, it feels different, I'm sure, than it used to, but does it have a different effect on you? Like, is it more empowering? Does it make you feel a different way coming off stage than it used to?
Yeah, absolutely. I was afraid of music, and now it's muscular and celebratory. And I know that it's all passion. In our lives, we tend to say this feels good and this feels bad. But in music, it's not colored emotionally, oddly. It's colored with passion. And you can't take any of it personally any longer. So it becomes a real... It's just nice to have in your quiver that ability to take anything that happens in your life and make it both impactful and passionate, and yet you don't suffer for it.
Right. Kristen Hirsch, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, John.
Kristen's latest book, and boy, it's a good one, is a memoir, Seeing Sideways, a memoir of music and motherhood. You can find her music all over the place wherever you listen to music. Here's Kristen Hirsch with Michael Stipe of REM on backing vocals. It's a song from 1994 called Your Ghost.
You were last night. You were driving circles around me. Last night, you were driving circles around me. You were last night.
Next time on Depression Mode, the future of mental health treatment is not black and white. In fact, it might be psychedelic.
Doing that really helped me in my life. And, you know, the people I was there with, you know, they were not kind of people who just wanted to go on some sort of like novel, fun trip. They were people who were really suffering with different things in their lives. They seemed to get a lot out of it. You know, I sound like such a convert, or like I'm proselytizing or something like that. But there's a reason that people do these things, right? Which is that for certain people, they do seem to work.
If people support our show, we can keep having a show. If they don't, we can't. It's just that simple. So if you already support the show, thank you so much. You are making this thing happen. If you don't yet support the show, don't worry. It's easy to do. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join, find a level that works for you, and then click on Depression Mode. We really appreciate it. We like existing. Be sure to hit subscribe, give us 5 stars, write rave reviews. All of that really helps us out. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text the word HOME to 741741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. We talk about the show a little bit in it, but it's about way more than just the show. It's about people coming together and having open, honest conversations about mental health. We'd like you to join. I'm on Twitter @JohnMoe. Our Substack newsletter is available. Just search up Depression Mode or search up my name on Substack. You'll find it. Hi, Credits listeners. When I reached out to Kristen Hirsch for this interview, I told her that I had been in my kitchen trying to do the Michael Stipe vocal part in that song, Your Ghost, but I just couldn't do it. And Kristen wrote back, ha 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 ha, I can't do Stipe's part either. He's a freak. That made me feel better. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, and we get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
Hey, this is Tom from Bloomington, Indiana. Just gotta say, things are gonna be all right. Keep on keeping on.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.